Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. We live in an era of cultural whiplash. Never has the potential for technological advances been more pronounced, and at the same time, the potential for wrenching societal dislocations seemingly so threatening. What are we to make of such times as these? Should we be excited or fearful, optimistic or quaking in our boots? For answers, I thought I'd turn to George Gilder, one of America's most prominent and innovative thinkers about technology and the economy, and a co-founder of the Discovery Institute, where he directs Discovery's Technology and Democracy Project, and is a senior fellow of the Center on Wealth and Poverty. Mr. Gilder attended Exeter Academy and Harvard University. At Harvard, he studied under Henry Kissinger and helped found Advance, a journal of political thought. In the 1970s, as an independent researcher and writer, Gilder began an excursion into the causes of poverty and wealth, which led to his best-selling Wealth and Poverty. A few of his more recent books are Knowledge and Power, The Information Theory of Capitalism, which won the Leonard R. Reed Prize at Freedom Fest in 2013. He also penned Life After Google, The Fall of Big Data and the Rise of the Blockchain Economy, Gaming AI, Why AI Can't Think But Can Transform Jobs, and Life After Capitalism, The Meaning of Wealth, The Future of the Economy, and The Time Theory of Money. Gilder is a contributing editor of Forbes magazine and a frequent writer for The Economist, The American Spectator, The Harvard Business Review, The Wall Street Journal, and other publications. He is also chairman of Gilder Publishing, LLC, located in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. George, welcome to Humanize.
Well, great to be here. I don't remember ever writing for The Economist, but I realized that I did once. So,
well, that's good enough.
Right? Or maybe twice over the years. Hundreds of times for the Wall Street Journal, though, which you didn't mention. I don't know. It's sort of a somewhat capricious list of my writings. But anyway.
Well, you're very prolific. It's unbelievable, and you're still going strong. Let me start with this. What led you and Bruce Chapman to co-found the Discovery Institute?
Well, we were part of the Hudson Institute at the time, and the Hudson Institute was sponsoring us, and we would have been perfectly satisfied to run the Hudson Institute, but events occurred, which I can't recall, which ended up propelling us to Seattle, where Bruce had always wanted to live, and where we'd spent a summer before, and so we established the Discovery Institute in Seattle, and really to integrate science and Christianity, and you know that our belief was that Christianity and the Judeo-Christian tradition was not subversive of science, but really almost indispensable to it. That the idea that we lived in a random universe did not yield great scientific insights, and it was not base for our technological progress, which I was writing about. I was writing newsletters on semiconductors back at the time.
Yeah, and the rest, as they say, is history. I mean, Discovery has really thrived in the years since you guys founded it. But let me ask you this. Your education is in political science, and you've had a long career interest in economics. More recently, you turned your focus to emerging technologies and their impacts on economics. Why are those subjects in particular of such interest to you?
Well, I think the real source of human prosperity is individual initiative and enterprise and creativity and the image of our Creator. And I've been writing about technology ever since 1980. And in the course of writing Wealth and Poverty, I discovered the microchip. And I actually gave a microchip. I showed Ronald Reagan his first microchip and said it would enable his SDI to prevail. Which is
the Strategic Defense Initiative, which was a missile defense system.
Yeah, that's right. I handed him a 16K DRAM from Micron Technology and told him this device was going to change the world. And it did. It's the foundation for all our information technologies and is the source of the AI revolution. And it's now coming to an end. We're moving to a world beyond chips and through wafer scale integration. If you want the details, technology is not proceeding toward a singularity. We are not aiming to create a new divinity, unitary divinity. Technology liberates human beings and thrives to the extent that human beings are emancipated.
Well, I was going to ask you whether you call yourself a techno-optimist, but that's pretty obvious.
Discovery is, I brought in Gail Pooley, who's the co-author of a book that I introduced called Superabundance, which really shows that technological and economic progress has been just immensely greater than is measured in any of our statistics. All our economic statistics are pretty much bunkum, in my view. And that's why I wrote Life After Capitalism last year, which was the information theory of economics. And
so let me ask, is GDP a false measure for economics?
Yes, it is. GDP, it's gross domestic product, and it values government spending as worth its cost. Under all circumstances, even if you decide to spend $6 trillion putatively over the years subsidizing windmills and solar panels that are utterly worthless, obsolete technologies, solar panels have some marginal uses. Windmills have zero use. They just complicate. They occupy land and complicate the power grid.
And they kill birds.
and they kill birds, and there's just, you know, for us to actually contemplate $6 trillion of subsidies and supports for windmills, Don Quixote's windmills, shows that government spending can be totally negative. And government spending, though, is valued at its cost, whatever it is, in GDP, while private sector enterprise is calculated through the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, which is just, you know, great big buildings in Washington filled with economists trying to figure out what things are worth, and they fail every time. And as our book, Superabundance, by Gail Pooley and Marion Tupi demonstrates, economic growth has been thousands of times greater over the centuries than is measured by economists, and still is two or three times greater than the GDP measures.
That's interesting. Let's talk about artificial intelligence. You know, I'm really a layperson when it comes to this stuff. I hear about AI all the time, but I'm still not exactly sure what it is. Is it just a super fast computer, or is it something more than that?
It's a super fast computer. It's the next generation of computer technology, and it's people been I think the most important application of it so far is probably Elon Musk's using artificial intelligence for self-driving automobiles, and this is and robots, but the artificial intelligence that's based on the reports of everything encountered by millions of Tesla cars around the world is an actual real achievement that will probably be widely applicable and will enhance jobs. People don't get employed because they're unproductive. People get employed because they're productive. And by increasing the productivity of human effort, it will increase jobs and enhance jobs rather than displace them.
What are you going to do with the millions of truck drivers who could be thrown out of work if you ended up with self-driving trucks?
What do you do with the millions of farmers who got displaced when the agricultural revolution happened? They'll do better things than driving trucks. Driving trucks probably doesn't tap all the human and inventive capabilities of all the men who drive those trucks. They'll get better jobs. Truck driving is not the supreme attainment of human life. It's really reducing human beings to kind of robotic roles to a great extent. And so all those questions I believe are false. All the questions about what human beings are going to do when they're more capable of doing more things.
So it sounds like you're saying this is going to unleash human creativity.
Yes,
which it will. Which will also improve the economy and so forth.
Yeah. Yep.
Let me ask again, because I want us to understand AI if we can. We hear the term intelligence. Is that an accurate term for use of computers? Aren't they basically enslaved, if you will, to their programs?
Yep. They're artificial intelligence is a creation of human intelligence. It tries to simulate human intelligence by injecting by a random number generator. The AI people imagine that human intelligence is best captured by randomness. And I don't think human creativity can be depicted as random. It's the opposite of random. So at the root of the idea that AI will usurp human minds is a fundamental misconception of what human minds are and what they do, and why they're unique in the universe, and why they I believe that to the extent that human minds are emancipated, human progress occurs. To the extent we try to subject human minds to various government programs and controls, human progress is stifled. So,
I think one of the
AI will be a multi. It's not a singularity. It's a multiplicity, and ultimately, it will be as creative as the 8 billion human minds on Earth can make it.
That's a really good point, because creativity is part of human exceptionalism. And what you said really struck me is that AI's intelligence was created by human intelligence. AI does not have the capacity to create. Only humans have the capacity to create. Would you agree with that?
Well, it depends. Humans create AI, which can and direct it to certain activities that are deemed creative.
That would
creative.
Be like a tool of our own creation. We are creating through the tool of AI.
That's right. AI is currently based mostly on internet data. And the idea that somehow from the streams and masses of internet data emerges some creative intelligence that can attain a singularity and become a kind of godlike force, usurping human beings and rendering them irrelevant, is one of the great idiocies of our time. It shows the sterility of atheism and
it's kind of the desperation of the transhumanist.
The materialist desperation of the transhumanist. That's a good it's just not what AI is. And the fact that they, in order to simulate human creativity, as they call it, imitate it, they inject randomness, just shows they have no idea what human creativity is. They almost admit it. They actually believe they don't know what human creativity is, because they're afflicted with the materialist superstition, the belief that we're all matter in motion, and to the extent we have ideas, they're emergent from material contingencies. And I think it's a false philosophy, and it actually limits the progress of technology rather than emancipates it.
What are some of the benefits that someone like me, who is not techno able at all, can expect to achieve with AI in the next few years?
Well, I think it's it makes a better search engine. I mean, even the Google search engine or the Microsoft Copilot or any of these things are very good search engines. They're fed by internet data, and they can find they're an encyclopedia that's instantaneously available, and that's a valuable tool. It amplifies an intellectual activity. To the extent that it tries to simulate, synthesizes intelligent writing, I think it's actually, and this is how it's widely used, it's going to result in a kind of devaluation of most of the written material that we see. Your podcasts are going to become more attractive and more, because right now already we're inundated with these synthetic writing that tells you what people always used to think, or what the consensus is of what people think, and it's not especially edifying, and it's devaluing prose, and I think that's I get 20 emails from President Trump every day, and if President Trump wanted to reach me, I really don't know how he could do it. I think his team has got this. It's all synthetic. It's all artificial intelligence, and it's it looks like communications for President Trump, but after you've got the first 700, you realize that if you're really dumb, most of us could tell within minutes, but you realize that these are not real communications. These are just noise.
And we're going to have to learn how to kind of distinguish between human communication and bot communication, it seems to me.
Yeah, that's right.
I've been reading that AI will be incredibly beneficial in terms of things like medical research. Why would that be so?
Well, I think that it just allows you to explore millions of possibilities systematically in a way that an individual human being moving step by step couldn't accomplish. I mean, I think the first breakthrough of AI where it's actually useful is going to be self-driving automobiles. I don't think we benefit a great deal from hanging on a steering wheel for hours every day all across the world. I think self-driving cars is going to be a real gain for humanity, and I think that's And that's based not on internet data, but which is based on human language and is thus several steps separated from an actual experiential reality. But Musk is using the inputs from the cameras on all his millions of cars and is building up the intelligence of a truck driver. And when you think the billions of trillions of tokens of imagery from automobile cameras that's needed to ultimately contrive a single safe driver, you realize that AI is really constantly paying tributes to the human minds that create it.
I read an interview just actually in preparing for our discussion, Ross Dutat of the New York Times, with an AI person who's the opposite of you, very pessimistic, very fearful, who basically said that AI will learn how to create its own computer programs and eventually will consider humans to be superfluous. What are your thoughts about that?
This is the kind of idiocy that technologists can adopt. I mean, it's nonsense. They think the human mind is some sort of collection of pixels or tokens and shuffled at tremendous speeds. And it has no idea of what humans are, and so it's no idea of any central consciousness in the universe, no notion of God or a creator or no concept of a meaningful universe. And with no concept of a meaningful universe, they believe all the meaning can gravitate to their computer systems, which is
kind of sad.
Delusional.
It's sad.
If they make fools of themselves and actually stifle the technology. I mean, there's no AI apocalypse ahead, or it's another computer platform. I've been writing about them for 40 years now, and computer scientists always anthropomorphize their machines,
in the end, they're inanimate.
Their professional flaw. It's the materialist superstition, as I call it.
Here's an area that I am concerned about. You look at the Chinese social credit system, in which China, which are, you know, the tyrants of the CCP, use AI, facial recognition technologies, and so forth, and a cashless society to really control the Chinese people, where they can, they force the Chinese people to have apps in their phones, and if the person is deemed to be antisocial, which means perhaps anti-communist, then they can actually prevent them from getting jobs, prevent them from riding public transportation, and this kind of thing. Now, that's, of course, using these technologies by humans for evil ends. So you do see that potential, I assume.
I do, but I don't think it's the situation has changed as much as you imply. What you're assuming is a diabolical communist regime. And if we have Stalin and Hitler, and we've seen diabolical regimes that didn't need any artificial intelligence to enhance their depredations. So I think it's just an illusion. It's this inflated belief of a generation of technologists that they've attained a kind of eschaton. As Bill Buckley, my old friend from way back, put it, they're eminentizing the eschaton. The eschaton is a final thing. And you know, the IBM people thought the IBM mainframe was a final thing. And back in 1956, I think, at Dartmouth Conference, John McCarthy, all the great computer scientists gathered and predicted that in a couple summers, or maybe even a single summer application, they could produce a computer that would outperform human brains. well, human computers do outperform human brains at computation. They always have. There's no problem with that. It has nothing to do with usurping human minds, creative in the image of their creator.
Let's talk about the singularity again just for a bit. People like Ray Kurzweil of Google, who I know you know him, who writes that he believes that the singularity will come, it will be then become unstoppable, there will be a merging of human and machine, and eventually it will lead to a quasi-immortality. Now, I think that's crackers. He's going to die just like you and I are going to die at some point, but does seem to be a real attraction of that kind of thinking for people who are desperate for hope when they have a materialistic mindset and think that all we really are a bunch of carbon molecules who think that we exist.
Yeah, well, that's a good depiction. Ray is quite a sophisticated and fascinating guy and was a great inventor in his time. And I think he's stumbled in this concept of a singularity, because it really is a kind of God substitute. He might not deem it a God substitute, but that's what it really is. People who don't believe in God don't believe in nothing, as Chesterton put it. Yeah. They'll believe in anything. And, yeah. But the whole point of mind is that it's multiplicity. It's not a singularity. There are 8 billion of us, and to the extent that we get emancipated and we can enhanced by our tools, as we always have been throughout human history, particularly since the Industrial Revolution.
And the mind and the brain, as one of the Discovery Institute's great books illustrates, are not the same thing. The mind and the brain are different things.
They are different things. And I think Kurzweil and all the great AI theorists are baffled by minds. So they reduce it to the brain and then reduce the brain to a computational machine, and they thus escape the need to have any larger philosophy, and that impoverishes all their thinking. I mean our AI, on YouTube you can find I've been writing about AI for maybe 40 years.
Yeah,
I've heard it all, and it was a breakthrough to be able to do the massively parallel processing with graphics processors that NVIDIA pioneered by buying a company in Israel called Mellanox, and which at the time had a bigger presence in data centers than NVIDIA did, as Jensen Huang of NVIDIA acknowledges. And this combination of instantaneous communications that allows you to integrate a whole data center into a single computational engine was a great feat. And it's given us what we call AI, which is as flawed as internet data is flawed. It's all based on internet data, finding consistencies in internet data, and that's information, as Claude Shannon, the founder of information theory and really the founder of much of our computer science, has said, information is surprise. It's unexpected bits. It's surprisal. And if the information is predictable by a computer, it's not even information.
In 2018, in your book, Life After Google, you predicted that the monopolistic reign of Silicon Valley will be coming to an end and that computer technology will become dispersed. Is that beginning to happen?
That is happening. I go to Israel a lot, and Israel is a major center of creativity and computer science and biotech and all these areas. And I've just spent a week in Houston, which is the center of the new carbon economy, which is pioneering a new material called graphene, which is a single layer of carbon atoms that all the previous physics declared would just dissolve, that a single layer of graphite would not cohere. And instead we discovered that a single two-dimensional layer of graphite is 200 times stronger than steel. It's 1,000 times more conductive than copper. It switches in the terahertz, trillions of times a second, rather than the gigahertz like silicon. It's elastic as rubber. It's been used in the space program. It's in all our Ford cars. It ultimately will result in a new carbon age where just as the steel age and the aluminum age will be succeeded by a carbon epoch with graphene as the sort of epitome of its new material. And the new physics that underlies graphene has been awarded 4 or 5 Nobel Prizes so far, because the properties of graphene could not be explained by the conventional quantum propositions. New topological physics is emerging to explain graphene. But anyway, the silicon age is going to be, I believe, microchips will be replaced by wafer scale graphene systems that are data centers on a single wafer rather than 3D chips and chiplets all interconnected with optical transceivers and a huge climax of complexity that the current Silicon Valley solutions are.
So basically, what I'm hearing you say, and it's very interesting, I mean, from the time of the Luddites, we've been predicting that technology was going to bring down the good life. And instead, what's happening is we keep finding new and better and more productive and more efficient means of accomplishing human goals. And that actually is almost a never-ending process.
I believe that's right. I don't think that the current AI breakthrough is more dramatic than the internet breakthrough or the microchip breakthrough in the 80s or the previous invention of the transistor or the discovery of aluminum replacement of the Bessemer process for making steel with electric arc furnaces that could recycle scrap. It's just another phase of information technology and it's and those are good. They enhance human minds and there are new tools.
But they come faster than ever. It's kind of almost you just start to get used to one thing and then it's replaced by something else.
Yes.
Especially when you get to be my age, a little older, and it's a little harder to adjust to the newness of everything that keeps pouring forth. Except you have a young heart, so you just embrace it and run with it.
I run with it. I'm a distance runner. I recently got a silver medal in the world over 85 running championships in the 10K.
Well, good for you.
I'm a runner.
I want to talk about a kind of associated issue that you've written about that I know very little about, so I'm going to sit at your knees and learn, which has to do with currency and money. First off, what is blockchain? I'd never heard that term until I read it in some of your work.
Well, blockchains are a new way to create a stable money that is rooted in time.
What does that mean?
Money is essentially time. William Nordhaus of Yale won a recent Nobel Prize for his invention of time prices, and money is essentially time. It's the if when you run out of money, you're essentially running out of the time to earn more money. And when government just prints money wantonly, as existing governments are doing, in order to escape the need to tax their citizens into a rebellion, they're really stealing time. It's stealing from the future. And blockchain is a system whereby you can't create. I have a whole theory of which I expound in Life After Google, which was my most recent best-selling book. It sold most in China. It was a worldwide bestseller, but the Chinese bought it more than anywhere else. But blockchain does offer the possibility of creating a new monetary system, global monetary system that
it's based on time, you say? It's based on time?
It's ultimately based on time. The time it takes to validate a block of transactions is the foundation for the consistent value of a currency based on blockchain. The trouble with the current system is that it's the current blockchains are mostly in the thrall of what they call stable coins, which mean that their value is ultimately linked to the dollar. And the dollar's value, of course, has dropped 99% in relation to gold since we left the gold standard. And so it's blockchain allows us to restore money to its crucial role, which is registering how much the worth of somebody's work, which is measured by the how much the goods and services that sustain our lives are cost and the amount of time we have to work to earn them. In other words, money is ultimately an expression of the time we have to work to purchase goods and services. And blockchain is a way of grounding that measurement in the passage of time. All the other standards, you know, for, and you know, the meter, the kilogram, the mole, the, all the various measures that underlie our measuring sticks are ultimately rooted in time, the speed of light. If you examine how you define a foot or a meter or a kilogram, or it's all ultimately rooted in the speed of light. That's what makes them consistent and coherent as measuring sticks. But our money now has been usurped by governments. And the governments just print it, which is a way from steal a way that incumbent governments can steal from the future, and that's why I think the blockchain revolution, the emergence of all these cryptocurrencies, as they're called, the real cryptocurrency is the dollar. The blockchain based currencies, when they get their act together, which they haven't quite done yet because of the dominance of Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is fine, except it's got this limit, which means that you can, which turns it from a currency really to an asset. You can, you know, a speculative asset, because there are only 21 million bitcoins that can ever be issued. It's very volatile and speculative and unsuitable as a currency. And I think that ultimately that there will emerge a global blockchain-based currency system.
Single currency everyone uses?
Yes. That's accurate because it's founded on time. Money is really an expression of the amount of time people have to work to earn it.
So if I work 2 hours, let's say, writing an op-ed, the amount of compensation that I would receive would depend on the time I spend in doing it?
Yes. I mean, it would depend on your op-ed. They purchase your op-ed, and its cost to you would be defined by the number of hours you had to spend writing it.
So that's the cost to me, but that isn't necessarily what they would determine to pay me if they wanted it.
Yeah, if they wanted it, to them, it might be worth more that you used AI and produced your op-ed in a few seconds. And if they really liked it, they might pay you for a 10-hour op-ed. But the point is not these that money registers the amount of time you have to spend to earn goods and services, and when the government debauches money by just printing it wantonly, as it is doing now, it no longer they steal from the future is what they're doing. They're falsifying the ultimate roots of money in the passage of time.
But can't the same thing be said of cryptocurrency, which is, to me, I mean, as a total layperson on this, I don't understand it. You just say, okay, we now have these bitcoins, and suddenly people say, okay, that's a means of exchange. Is that basically all that's necessary, is for people to agree this is going to be a means of exchange?
I don't think Bitcoin is a very good means of exchange. It's not used as a means of exchange much at all. Bitcoin is almost entirely a speculative asset.
All right, but how about other crypto, other cryptocurrency?
Well, I believe that Ethereum is better, Solana is better. These cryptocurrencies are experimenting and attempting to create a new currency that people will accept, and which prevents governments from falsifying the message of money and stealing from the future. This is really the current function of monetary policy, is to artfully steal from the future. And
but George, I still don't understand how a cryptocurrency is created. I just sit down at my computer and I say, okay, we're now going to be creating the Smith, which is going to be based, you know, a cryptocurrency based on the Smith ideal of the kind of time that is required to put this together.
Which is what blockchains do. And there's a new currency called Hedera, which has been widely adopted, that's also based on blockchains. It's a different form of blockchain. And these digital currencies, to the extent that they don't falsify the limited number of what remains scarce when everything else grows abundant, is time. That's the scarce resource. And to the extent that, and money, the reason money works is because it allows my time to be converted into your time so that you can buy a newsletter from me and I can buy other services from you, and they're unified by a government-defined unit of account. And I think that until the eclipse of the gold standard, money actually meant something. We had no what's called inflation at all for centuries under the gold standard, because the gold standard was governed by the amount of time it took to extract an incremental ounce of gold. And as we used more and more gold, the time it became increasingly arduous to extract gold with more advanced technologies. But essentially, gold was an index of the time it took to extract it, and it rooted money in a measure of time. And when we and because it's time is inexorable and scarce and infinite in extent, but scarce in the moment, it imposes real constraints on governments. And so governments have rebelled against it and created these what I believe are essentially spurious currencies, and that lose value steadily and don't offer a reliable guide for enterprise. And
But crypto would face the same issues, wouldn't it? If I decided, okay, I'm creating the Smith currency, the cryptocurrency, it's worthless unless a lot of people decide, yeah, that's currency.
Yeah, that's right. So, and I believe ultimately that businesses and individuals will want real currency rather than currency that can be debauched by governments and rendered worthless. I mean, the government constantly consumes our savings by debauching our currency.
But how will we know? How will we know what real currency, to use your term, is? How will we understand that this is real currency where the Smith isn't the real currency?
Because people will, I think people will choose a currency. For centuries, they chose the gold standard. Mm-hmm. And essentially, the blockchain is a new form of gold standard. It really is. It's rooted in the what remains scarce when all else grows abundant, namely the passage of time. And that's the source of how blockchains work. And if the cryptocurrency is based on a legitimate blockchain, it will not be infinitely expansible. It will be constrained by the passage of time, and thus will register values as money under the gold standard, registered values reliably for centuries.
I'm thinking about this, and it's way over my head, but isn't this almost a form of anarchy in the sense that the determination of whether a currency has value will be dependent upon what people individually think? And how do we get 8 billion people on the planet to agree to a single currency?
Well, they did. If they did before, they can do it again. We're really in an absurd world now where individual governments issue their own currencies with just a nominal value, whatever they want to define it. Periodically, the currency gets completely debauched, as in Argentina, and you get a Javier Milei who comes in and reestablishes a reasonably valid currency. But this is monetary chaos, and it really means that we need the invention of a new money, and Satoshi did it, I believe, with the blockchain. It's been improved maybe by Hedera, which has a simpler and perhaps more functional blockchain. We'll see, but ultimately, value is measured in time prices, and the news is mostly good. Measured by time prices, our standard of living has been improving since the Industrial Revolution at a rate many times faster than economists estimate, and our problem, as you understand, is a religious and family problem, not an economic problem fundamentally.
I'd like to talk to you about that at some point. We don't have time today, and we're basically out of time, but I do want to ask you, you know, people who listen to this podcast are average folk. They're not specialists in the areas you are. What should we do to prepare for the emerging technological world that you're envisioning?
I think we ignore the warnings of apocalypse and all these, kind of singularity fantasies, and proceed to use the technologies that emerge to enhance our lives and capabilities. And that will, that's the way humans have progressed always, to the extent that some communist vision or some green vision of windmills and solar panels dominates our lives, we'll move backwards.
Saying this will actually unleash creativity by doing away with overly oppressive central planning.
That's right. That sums it up. I like the image of the red ocean strategy versus the blue ocean strategy. I don't know whether you've heard that before, but the red ocean assumes we're in a cutthroat world where of scarcity, where gains for one person impoverish another person, and this is really the Marxist vision, where if somebody's rich, it explains the poverty of somebody else, and the blue ocean strategy, which is where human creativity in the image of their creator opens infinite blue skies of potential for human lives.
Well, this has been your entire career promoting that kind of optimistic assessment. And all I can say is I hope you're right.
Well, thank you, Wesley. I enjoy reading your stuff every week, and hope you keep at it.
Well, I can't stop now. What next for George Gilder? You've got such a bottomless pit of enthusiasm and energy, and in your 80s running 10Ks. What next for you that we can take a look at in the next coming few months and years?
Well, I think the wafer scale technology that Musk is pioneering, really, in Tesla. And in the next few weeks, we're going to have self-driving cars from Tesla, and we'll see robo-taxis from Tesla, and we'll see if they work or not. I thought they needed LiDAR. I won't go into it, but Musk is relying entirely on AI to run his robo-taxis. Self-driving, full self-driving cars, and it's a great breakthrough. It's really the one achievement. And Musk has previously launched Starlink.
Real achievement where he can bring internet anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I mean, Musk is the greatest entrepreneur of our lifetimes, and I think we'll see how he does with this AI based. Self-driving car that's going to be launched in Austin in the next few weeks, and we'll see how it works.
Well, let's hope it works well and that people are safe. Anyway, George, thank you very much for stopping by and for at least helping me understand some of these current trends in technology and currency.
Well, thank you, Wesley. Thank you for enduring my blather for...
It was a pleasure. Thank you, George.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.